Okay, so our class is on the theme of how to talk to kids about difficult subjects, and we're currently in the phase of trying to figure out what our own opinion is so that we can then talk to our kids about it in a future lesson. So today has nothing to do with kids. It's entirely about can we figure out what we can say and what we can't say about same-sex attraction, with the hope that once we understand it perfectly, we'll have great things to say to our kids about it. So that'll go well, right? Book recommendation. I'm a big fan of Nancy Piercy's book, Love Thy Body. It has sections on sexuality, transgenderism, and a handful of other body-related topics. And it's pretty recent and pretty good. So if you're wanting the long version of this, go look there. So let me start with just a few passages from Scripture. You say, Ben, what does the Bible say about same-sex attraction and same-sex relationships? There's a temptation to start out in the book of Leviticus. I have one thing to say to that. Don't use the verse in Leviticus. Okay? Not because it's false. It's not. Not because it's bad. It's not. It's just anything in Leviticus comes with strings attached that are complicated. So if you're in a casual conversation and you bring up Leviticus, you've already got 30 minutes worth of work to do to explain what's going on in Leviticus. Similar in just a few verses over from where it says same-sex relationships are an abomination, it says don't cut your hair with a curve at the back. You know, it's okay. So I think I could parse out which one of those is more important and what the meaning of each was, but I've been doing this a long time. So just ask somebody, here's Leviticus, enjoy. So instead, what I say is, it just so happens there were these guys in the New Testament who believed in Jesus who had all read Leviticus and knew what was in there and took the sexual ethics of Leviticus Deuteronomy and restated it for stupid Gentiles like us to understand. So let's read what they wrote, and it's going to be a lot simpler. Okay, so that's my two cents. By all means, study Leviticus. I love Leviticus, but if I'm just talking to someone, especially my kids, about this topic later on, Leviticus is not my starting place. Although, oddly enough, it probably was for Paul. That's where he would have said, oh, well, Leviticus says, you know.
I also know it's the verse of go-to for most Christians wanting to talk about same-sex attraction. Like, those who are of same-sex attraction can quote that verse from Leviticus back to you, and that just ends the conversation.
Yeah.
They already automatically think they're an abomination.
It has the word abomination in it, which is just such a strong, loaded word, which, again, means something in Leviticus. Not everything that's bad in Leviticus is called an abomination. Relatively few things are. It's things related to sexual behavior and idolatry are the two things that get that label. And there's like meaning there. But again, are you going to have a 30-minute conversation about the meaning of the word abomination to a person who just got offended because you called them an abomination?
Abomination is pretty bold.
Yeah.
NLT says detestable.
Detestable?
Which is right there with you.
Yeah. So it's a revulsion word. And because Leviticus's point is, that's how God feels about sexual immorality and idolatry. He made you to do something and you're not doing it and he's unhappy. Again, so don't do Leviticus. I got four or five verses that if I'm given 10 or 15 minutes to talk about same-sex attraction, I'm going to walk through the New Testament, and these are my verses I'll do in quick succession. The first is James chapter 1, 13 through 15. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, brings birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. I start with this passage because I think it's important to notice a couple of things. The process by which sin occurs begins with a desire. The desire is not the sin in and of itself. The desire is a tool used in temptation that leads to sin. Okay, so you start with, there's something you desire. It may or may not be good or bad. The desire is then used as a lure to entice you, and then sin is one possible result. So I like to start there because we do have to talk a little bit in this conversation at some point, the difference between same-sex attraction and same-sex relationships and sexuality. That one is, I have this desire, and I'm not sure what to do with it. One is an action or behavior. And this passage reminds us that there is actually some space in between desires and behavior that we need to at least recognize up front. Next passage I want to mention, probably Hebrews 13:4, although I could be talked into others. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. Marriage and sexuality does matter to God. That's one common quip is, why does God care about my sexuality? Because he invented it. Like, he created it. He designed marriage with a purpose. He designed your body with a purpose and a function. And he blesses it where he put it. Marriage is this beautiful, wonderful thing that God made. And he is therefore opposed to all things that are not that, that are other than what he created. Lengthier section in Matthew 19. Have you not read, this is the section where they ask Jesus, can we get divorced for any reason? Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. Because of the hardness of your heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. Why do I talk about that one? Notice none of the verses we've talked about yet have anything to do with same-sex anything. This is all groundwork of just, what's the conversation? The conversation is, marriage matters to God. The creation of male and female and of marriage is what Jesus references back to. Like, why, what is Jesus's view on the question of marriage? They ask him about divorce, but we could apply it to anything. What's Jesus's view? He says, well, how did God make it? However God made it is what he intended, and that's what ought to be reverenced. So he hearkens back to that. I also like to mention this verse in the conversation because it gives us an opportunity to talk about divorce a little bit. That there is something where we have said divorce is, speaking in generalities for a minute, in general terms, divorce is sinful, in general terms. But then also we've said in churches, we're going to find ways to minister to divorced persons and have them here and help them to have good marriages and so forth. And that, I think, is a good parallel to where we have to get on the question of same-sex attraction, that we're going to have to find a way to say, yeah, the Bible does say this, and also, please come here, we'd like to minister to you and find a way to help you have a healthy life. And that's going to be tricky, like it is on divorce, but it's an interesting place to think about that. Two more verses, and then we'll pause, I promise. Finally, something about the topic, Romans 1:26-27. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing the shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. Paul has clearly read Leviticus. Like, this is, Romans is almost like a comment, Paul's commentary on Old Testament passages. And this is one place where his sexual ethic is really obvious of just, he's read Leviticus. Even the word shameless is kind of him channeling the word abominable or detestable to a Roman audience that wouldn't know what Leviticus was about. He said, well, shameless, right? He's interpreting that for us. And then one more passage, 1 Corinthians 6:9-11, which was in this morning's sermon. Yeah, God does care about right and wrong. The unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God. Here's the list. Sexually immoral, idolaters, adulterers, men who practice homosexuality, thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers. And such were some of you. But you were washed, but you were cleansed, justified in the name of Christ Jesus by the Spirit of our God. Okay. There, on those last two passages, there's a fair bit of noise out in the interwebs from people who would want to tinker with the meaning of the words. Maybe practice homosexuality doesn't mean, maybe it means homosexual prostitution and not monogamous homosexual relationships. Like, that argument comes up of what it means. I'm trying to do the short version today, but I'll just tell you, it really is wishful thinking. There's nothing grammatically, linguistically, lexiconography-ly that lends itself to that point. Corinth had every kind of sexual relationship the modern world has. They were not stupid. They had everything we have and more. And Paul knew exactly what he's referencing. Early translations didn't use the word homosexuality because, well, neither did the Corinthians because they didn't speak English, and also the word didn't exist. The original text actually has two Greek terms that have been combined to give us men who practice homosexuality. One is the King James translates it, nor the effeminate, nor the abusers of mankind. And it's one is a word, literally the Greek word for soft. It just means person who is presenting themselves as a woman who is not. And the other is one is presenting themselves masculine who is not. Like literally, it's just a combo of words to describe two possible parts of a relationship. It's the words that they would have used in Corinth. It's euphemisms that they would have understood. And yeah, I'm sure it applied to prostitution as well, but that's not what he said. So want more on that. Someday I could go into some of the linguistic stuff, but I'm pretty confident it means what it looks like it says. So biblically speaking, those are my verses. These are the four points I make on Ben's view. Number one, misplaced desire tempts us, but is not necessarily a sin. Okay. So desire is not the same thing as sin. It doesn't mean all desires are good. You can have unhealthy desire. That, in fact, got news for you. All of you have unhealthy desires. All of us do. It's a question of what do we do with these desires? Okay. You are going to be tempted by your desires. Okay. Whatever that happens to be. Sex is holy in the covenant of marriage, but sex outside the covenant of marriage is immoral. That's the way marriage is treated biblically. You don't get some of the statements we want to be clearer because it's so assumed and ingrained into the stories that marriage was something that God cared about deeply. Marriage is defined as a covenant between one man and one woman for life. Same-sex marriage would be sinful in the same degree as divorce would be. I like to combine those in a category because we view them differently, right? We have divorced people in our church. Okay, so we view them differently. But in theory, they're in the same category of things that are wrong that need to be righted somehow. And the question is, how do you do that? And churches have fought for decades, centuries, over how to handle divorce. Do they need to like stay single? Do they split up their second marriage or their fifth marriage? Or like what's the thing to do? Where we've kind of landed is, stop getting divorced is the way to repent of divorce. Like if you're married, stay married. If you're divorced, don't get divorced anymore. Like quit it. And so some version of that answer is where I hope we land with homosexuality, where there is a desire, we need to address it, we need to talk about it. There's a behavior that needs to be addressed. But in terms of revulsion or detestability, we're gonna have to think about that differently. Finally, homosexual activity is specifically mentioned as sinful in the New Testament. It can be repented of, and it can be forgiven. It's not especially sinful. It's not like in its own category of disgusting things in the New Testament. Leviticus comes close to that. But again, New Testament-wise, not as much. It's on the list of things that Paul said, some of you. And it's not in a special place in the list. Like it's right next to swindlers, right? Guarantee you there's some swindlers in our church. Right? I mean, just, of course there are. So it's on the list. Stop doing it, okay? But it's not in a special part of the list, okay? One more slide, promise, and then I'll pause. I have a 3-minute clip from N.T. Wright that I wanted to show because he gets asked about this. And what makes N.T. Wright interesting is, first of all, other side of the Atlantic. By American standards, N.T. Wright would be considered like a liberal progressive, very environmentalist, wants women to be priests and all part of ministry and egalitarian. Like we would consider him like on that side of the debate. Problem is, in England, like the same categories don't work anymore. So in England, he's a conservative, which is funny. So when the Anglicans introduced their debate about, are we going to accept same-sex marriage? He's the Bishop of Durham at the time, and he's avidly opposed to adopting same-sex marriage in the Anglican Church and took a lot of flack for it. Likewise, his buddy in America, his counterpart, Richard Hayes, Methodist, was the head of the Bible department at Duke, traditionally Methodist college, and said basically the same thing N.T. Wright's going to say in this video, and quickly became the former head of the Bible department at Duke. And neither of these guys are what you'd call fundamentalist. Okay, they're just New Testament Pauline scholars. Paul is their specialty, both guys, Richard Hayes and N.T. Wright. Their entire careers have been spent studying Paul. They read Paul and they're like, you don't have to like it. This is what Paul said. So I thought an interesting take on it.
Christian message in the light of the current legislation on the redefinition of marriage?
Yeah, I mean, obviously huge issues there, and there's no way we can lay them all out tonight. I do want to say a word about a word. When anybody, pressure groups, governments, civilizations, suddenly change the meaning of key words, you really should watch out. If you go to a German dictionary and just open it at random, you may well see several German words which have a little square bracket saying NS, meaning National Socialist or Nazi, that the Nazis gave those words a certain meaning. In post-1917 Russia, there were whole categories of people who were called former persons because by the communist diktat, they had ceased to be relevant for the state. And once you call them former persons, it was extremely easy to ship them off somewhere and have them killed. In the same way, there was a letter in the Times lit up just a few weeks ago saying that when we're talking about assisted suicide or something like that, we shouldn't actually use words like suicide and killing and those sort of words, because those imply that you shouldn't do it, whereas now our civilization is saying that maybe there are reasons for that. And I find that sort of stuff chilling, the attempt to change an ideology within a culture by changing the language. Now, the word marriage for thousands of years and cross-culturally has meant man and woman. Sometimes it's been one man and more than one woman. Sometimes, occasionally, it's been one woman and more than one man. There's certain polyandry as well as polygamy in some societies and in some parts of history. But it's always been male plus female. Simply to say that you can have a woman plus woman marriage or a man plus man marriage is radically to change that because of the givenness of maleness and femaleness. And I would say that without any particular Christian presuppositions at all, just cross-culturally that's so. With Christian or Jewish presuppositions, or indeed Muslim, then if you believe in what it says in Genesis 1 about the coming, about God making heaven and earth. And the binaries in Genesis 1 are so important that heaven and earth, and then the sea and dry land, and so on and so on, and you end up with male and female. And these, it's all about God making complementary pairs which are meant to work together. And the last scene in the Bible is the new heaven and new earth. And the symbol for that is the marriage of Christ and his church. So this stuff, it's not just one or two verses here and there which say this or that. It's an entire narrative which works with this complementarity so that a male plus female marriage is a signpost or a signal about the goodness of the original creation and God's intention for the eventual new heavens and new earth. If you say that marriage now means something which would allow other such configurations, what you're saying is actually that when we marry a man and a woman, we're not actually doing any of that stuff. This is just a convenient social arrangement, a social and a sexual arrangement, and there it is, get on with it. And it seems to me it's interesting. It isn't that, I think, that is the downgrading of marriage. It's something that has gone on clearly for some time, which is now poking its head above the parapet. Mm-hmm. That if that's what you thought marriage meant, then clearly we haven't done a very good job in society as a whole, in the church in particular, in teaching about just what a wonderful mystery marriage is supposed to be. So, I mean, simply at that level, I think it's a nonsense. It's like the government voting that black should be white. Sorry, you can vote that if you like, you can pass it by a total majority, but it isn't actually going to change the reality.
Yeah. Anyway, I find him super fascinating on everything, but that, I think, is the bird's eye view version of what the historic and traditional Christian view of those topics would be. I don't throw people out of church that disagree with me, but if you're going to ask me what the view is, I would say it's going to sound something like that, and it sounded like that for 2,000 years, and it sounded like that before Christianity. Like it's there was an interesting line from Justice Kennedy's opinion in the Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage, where he said, "We're not arguing with Christians here; we're arguing with ancient Babylonians. Like this isn't a recent development that marriage was defined in this way. It's pretty much the only thing history has known when it's used that word." So that's interesting. So let me pause, because I talked a lot. Questions on that you may have on, does the Bible have a position, or is that some sense of the Bible position of what the Christian view of that is? Promise no one gets thrown out of church if you have a hard question.
I'm having an issue trying to talk with people about intent, desire, and lust.
Yeah.
Whether it's actionable, mm-hmm. whether it's natural, whether it's passive, and since we're not debating whether or not it exists, mm-hmm. I would like to be able to articulate the culpability of somebody who chooses to act upon it as different from someone who is pulled towards it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Allow me then, since there were no other questions, to segue into my next point, which is well done. He's a plant. Yeah. The major drawback over the last few decades on this topic was kind of the nature versus nurture debate. Like, how much of this is just cooked into the cake, and I'm born this way, and it's the way it is. We live in an exciting time post 2019. Yes. I was literally doing this series of lessons for the first time with the church when the study I'm about to reference came out. Okay. And I was like, I've got to make new slides. Like, the science said something that had never been said before in this way. The early picture of attraction goes back to Kinsey in 1948. Okay, we've been working off of a model that's now over half a century old of what attraction looked like, and it was based on him interviewing people about sex. Psychologist interviewing people about sex, published his results, and the result led to everything we know now. Okay. We've done more math since then. Okay. 2019, studied by Ghana and a group of other guys. Okay. This is a study, peer-reviewed. This is not a fundamentalist newspaper. This is Nature magazine, and it was published and peer-reviewed, and they did an extensive study on the genetic influences of sexuality in general.
The people who did this were pro-homosexual researchers, too.
Yeah, they were hoping to find the definitive gay gene and then say, we're done. And they ended up unproving themselves, and being honest people, they published and said, this is what we found. These are our results. Yay, science. Like, this is how it's supposed to work. Let me give you some citations here. This is the largest study to date on the genetic basis of sexuality, has revealed 5 spots on the human genome that are linked to same-sex sexual behavior, but none of the markers are reliable enough to predict someone's sexuality. The findings, which were published on 29 August in Science and based on the genomes of nearly 500,000 people, shore up the results of earlier smaller studies and confirm the suspicions of many scientists. While sexual preferences have a genetic component, no single gene has a large effect on sexual behaviors. Pause a moment and let's talk statistics. 500,000 people. The previous studies that they referenced had been at most 1,000 or two. 500,000 data points in any study, that ain't bad, right? you're feeling pretty good about your data at that point. It's not a sample size issue. And it was across the globe. It wasn't all like people from Georgia or something. It was they got people from all over, 500,000 data points. And again, notice the honesty. Is there a genetic influence on sexuality? Of course there is. But it was not a reliable predictor of what would happen. They continue, and this is again a quote from the lead author. There is no gay gene, says lead study author Andrea Gana, geneticist at MIT and Harvard, Cambridge, Massachusetts. He said, that's what we found. And he was looking for it. He said, it's not what we found. His colleagues also used analysis to estimate that up to 25% of sexual behavior can be explained by genetics, with the rest influenced by environmental and cultural factors, a figure similar to the findings of smaller studies. So this is another one of those where we've been forced into pick a side, and both sides were stupid. One side wants to say it's all genetics, and one group wants to say no genetics at all. Of course they're genetics. Like, you have a body, it has DNA, you have genes and hormones and all that jazz. Of course there's a genetic component. The question is it a determinative component? Was it locked in at the moment your DNA solidified somewhere? And the answer is not at all. It's 25% influence and 100% picture.
Is it in the same way that you say that girls marry their fathers kind of thing?
Yeah, like the rest of it, what a young lady's looking for. There's a corollary to men, sure, as
yeah,
well.
The other way.
But what a young lady's looking for, there is a determining factor that is environmental, that they were raised in a household and learned to admire or hate a certain kind of man in their home, and that affects their future relationships. Does it perfectly, apparently I timed that slide, does it perfectly predict who they're going to marry? No, but it influences who they're going to marry, right? And so on. There's lots of things that influence the picture. That's not the same as determinative. So Francis Collin, again, I made this slide in 2019, he wrote back when he was more famous for his first big job, the Human Genome Project. He said, sexual orientation is genetically influenced but not hardwired by DNA, and that whatever genes are involved represent predispositions, not predeterminations. Mm-hmm. See the difference in those two? Predisposition, not predeterminations. There are lots of things you might be inclined toward genetically. I think alcoholism is one. And there's a handful of others. Republican and Democrat. There's an interesting study about political influence from genetics, and it's haunting because we're all free thinkers. We made up our own mind. Well, like, ish. Yeah, like, you probably made up some of your mind, and genetics, it matters. But neither is it 100% genetics. Like, there is some influence there. Another interesting name, if you want to go hunt this guy down, John Corvino, on the internet called the gay moralist. He's a philosopher, gay advocate, gay man. He hates the born this way narrative though, and writes against it. He says, it doesn't matter whether we're born this way. The fact is that there are plenty of genetically influenced traits that are nevertheless undesirable. He said, just proving that I'm born this way doesn't mean I should stay this way. He said, that doesn't help our case. Like, he's trying to make the pro-LGBTQ argument, and he says, genetic doesn't help. Just saying we're predisposed to be drunk doesn't mean that being drunk is okay because it's natural. He said, there are things in your DNA you should probably fight against. What if men started using the genetics argument to defend rape in court? I'm genetically predisposed to be a rapist. Like, I'm sure you could find some data.
Oh yeah, there
it is. It has to be, right? And I think we'd say, nice try, you're going to jail. Like, of course, maybe your DNA pushed you that way. You're supposed to do something about that. There are predispositions that are not desirable that you have to have some say in. So to the point Mark was bringing up, we are many things, including feelings, thoughts, biology, genetic, physical bodies, relationships, convictions, and we can add more descriptors on that, environment, history, experience, failures, successes. I mean, like, we're a big bundle of mess at what it means to be human. There's no reason to say that feelings override all the other factors or that genetics and override, like we're just all those things combined on every topic. Anger issues, there's a genetic component in anger, which means there's a genetic component in abusive relationships. I'm still going to say stop beating your wife. Right? There's something in there that you have to learn how to manage. All of us are broken in different ways, and we have to find how to deal with that.
Environment also influences over time how your genome is read.
Yep.
So if you are in an environment over time, your genome, it's not your genome that changes, but how your body reads it changes.
Yep.
So if you're in an abusive relationship, there's been a lot of studies on that one in particular. It not only influences you, but your epigenome is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
It can also influence your children.
Wow. Yeah.
Also, same thing like with starving. Over time, like the children are also predisposed. So like with violence, it's the children over time are predisposed to mental disorders.
Wow. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that's not them that went through the abusive. So
there's just been so much trauma in this one person
that
it's changing the way their body expresses it and the way it's
expressed and the way that the markers set on the genes. So then those markers that set on the genes can be inherited, and that's called the epigenome. And so changing the environment can influence over time.
It's nice to have
a
scientist in class.
Yeah, nice to have a scientist in class. From those life science people I always mock. I think we have it in our head that genetics is mathematics, that it's like just this cold, hard thing that just drops into your lap at birth. And it turns out humans are really complicated.
How do we respond? Just a couple of comments, and then if I have a second, well, I'll show you a quick video. We may run out of time.
Churches must be kind toward people with same-sex attraction without abandoning our convictions. Churches must allow people time and grace to work out these issues slowly. Like you, whatever your messed up part is, you didn't fix it overnight. In fact, you haven't fixed it, to be honest. God's still working on you, so we're going to have to make some time for this. We're going to have to listen more and talk less. You don't understand anybody else's brokenness but yours. In fact, you probably don't understand yours, but you can at least talk about it. So you're going to have to listen some. And we must not allow our lives, families, churches, society, and health to be destroyed by false narratives. Like on the personal level, I want to be as patient as humanly possible, as divinely possible. On the policy level, like there is an external reality. There is truth and reality in the world. Maybe making large-scale decisions based on that would be a good idea as a rule. Quick 3-minute trip to Rosaria Butterfield. Did I get her name right? I always say it wrong.
I always call her Buttercrunch, my wife.
Buttercrunch, yeah, it's not Buttercrunch, Butterfield. If you wanted to Google somebody else today and just see some interesting things, this is the story of a woman in feminist and queer studies who's a lesbian, finds Christ, and tries really hard not to convert, and does anyway. And her story of how that happened is fascinating.
When I became a Christian, I was also still very deeply rooted in the lesbian community. I had just broken up with my lover, but my heart was not in it at all. I was the faculty advisor to 4 or 5 student LGBT groups on campus. Like most research professors, I had lectures to give and classes to teach in queer theory. And quite frankly, when I first became a Christian, I was terrified because I fully expected the elders of my church to be standing in the back of my 300-person feminist theory class, you know, with placards like the kind I used to see at gay pride marches. And I was really terrified about this. And what I was really surprised by about Christians was that they gave me the grace to work out my relationships. And they understood that I was not a blank slate and that this wasn't going to get all cleaned up in a day. My pastor and my elders and their wives and my friends in the church treated me like a person who was working but was not going to get all cleaned up at once. And the other thing that really amazed me about Christians was that they were almost, I don't know, they were so sensitive to the fact that I had lost something that I valued. You know, nobody said to me, well, Rosaria, that was sinful. Let's move on. Nobody said that at all. I mean, people knew that my, it was a sinful relationship, but my ex-lover was an image bearer of a holy God, and she did amazing things in the world. And I was really going to not only miss her, but miss the house that we had together, miss our dogs and our dishes and the view of the lake from the window. I lost a lot, and I was amazed that my Christian friends knew that they grieved with me. I was also amazed at how kind my new
Let me pause there because I think the kids are coming down the hall. I'll show the rest of the video and one more actually next week, and we'll catch up on it. But she has such a great story of somebody did it really well with her.